You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, March 28th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, Lot. How is ya?
Good, sir.
Governor.
Right.
Guys, all getting ready for Nexus. That's our next big event coming up.
Yes.
Nexus.
So I got a couple of cool things going on at Nexus. I have Brian Wecht and I came up with a workshop that's going to happen on Thursday where we're going to talk about the most incredible things in sci-fi movies, like the most impactful scenes and why they're impactful, which I can't wait. I cannot wait to do that.
Wow.
Doing the research on that alone is going to be fun, but it'll be cool. We're going to show like a movie clip.
Give me an example, Jay. Like the setting binary stars on Star Wars, The New Hope?
Yeah, it's going to be more. I'm joining those guys for that one, too, because I wouldn't miss it. But the point is to talk about why is this scene iconic? Why has this become iconic? How did it reflect the culture? How did the culture reflect back on it, et cetera?
Fun.
Yeah, it should be fun.
Bob, as an example, like the alien coming out of the guy's chest. You know, I don't know if we're going to use that, but like – yeah, that left an impression on audiences. That's where like the movie went from scary to, you know, holy shit, run out of the theater. I have a favorite, but I'm not going to reveal it. You have to come to the workshop.
Fun.
And I'm going to be doing a workshop on how to survive in the fake news.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, the fake news, the alternative fact era.
Oh, boy.
How can a skeptic survive in this current environment?
That's great. We get emails all the time with people asking that question.
That's our most common question now.
Yeah.
It's like,
just
what
be
the
a
hell?
Skeptic.
What
the hell? Steve, are you going to be talking about like avoidance tactics? Or are you going to be talking about
like how to stay sane?
Giving
how to
find skills. Skills. Okay.
Identify. How do you know it's fake news?
Nunchuck skills.
Yeah. Right. Having a skeptical background, you know, cannot hurt. Certainly, I found it useful and I've been able to kind of help make my way through the morass of fake news that's out there, at least as best as I think I can. And certainly the skeptical chops that I've got has helped me along that way. So I think that'll be a real, real interesting session, Steve.
Yeah, sure. Really fun. Then we have a full day of that's the workshop on Thursday. Then we have a full day of science-based medicine on Friday. And then we have a great speaker lineup. We have an evening with James Randi Friday night. Then for Saturday and Sunday, we have Mike Massimino, who's a NASA astronaut. We have Britt Hermes, who's a former naturopath. She's been writing for us on science-based medicine. She has a lot of dirt to tell on naturopaths.
She's great.
Nice.
Summer Ash, that's a friend of yours, Kara. She's an astrophysicist.
Yeah. She actually runs all of the outreach for the Columbia astronomy department, which is really cool. So she gets, you know, people engaged in public science in New York City, where you don't often think of looking up.
Mm-hmm.
Then Massimo Pigliucci, who's a philosopher, who's we've had him before. He's awesome. Some guy named Jay Novella. I don't know who he is.
Some podcast. Some guy.
Oh, and look at this. So many good people. Look, John Rennie's going to be there. I love John Rennie.
Yeah. I love him
John
more.
I did a couple TV shows with John Rennie back in the day for the Weather Channel.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Right.
Hacking the Planet.
Hacking the Planet, yeah, and The Truth About Twisters. It was so much fun.
Whoa.
Oh.
And Jennifer Lopez is going to be speaking for us.
Jennifer Lopez. Different Jennifer Lopez. Cooler Jennifer Lopez.
This is the Jennifer Lopez NASA data knot core, yeah.
That's awesome.
The cool Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
Of course.
Indeed.
Yeah, don't forget Leanne Lord is our MC.
Very cool.
Yeah, so she's a very funny comedian, and it's going to be something different. Yeah,
without a doubt.
Yeah.
So the dates are June 29th to July 2nd, and you can go to nexus.org, necss.org, to read up about what we're doing, and you could register, and you can send us an email, whatever you want.
All right, guys, let's go on with the show. Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's forgotten superhero of science, I'm talking about Jane Cook Wright, 1919 to 2013. She was a pioneering woman cancer researcher who saved thousands of lives with her new innovative drugs and techniques. Probably more than many, many thousands. Wright's dad, Lewis, was one of the first African-American graduates from Harvard Medical School. In fact, her whole family was basically filled with doctors, a lot of firsts among them. Her dad, her granddad, her uncle. Yet she and her sister probably had the hardest time because they also had their gender working against them, as well as their race back, you know, going back, you know, over a century or so, you know, have, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago was a lot different than it is now. In 1952, she became the director of the Harlem Hospital Cancer Research Center, succeeding her dad who had founded it. In 1955, she started working as a researcher at the New York University Bellevue Medical Center as associate professor of surgical research and the director of cancer research. So it was around this time, you don't remember because you weren't around, that cancer was even scarier in the 40s, 50s, 60s, much scarier now than it is now. Cancer treatments were primitive. You know, we haven't had the wild success in cancer treatments that we have, that we anticipated and hoped, but it has been steady, incremental, successes, and, the survival rates now are just so much better. Now Wright was the first to realize that a drug called, methotrexate, works against tumors, and that drug eventually became one of the critical foundational chemotherapy drugs used on tumors. Her pioneering work was critical in transforming chemotherapy from what was a possibility and hypothetical and theoretical to a workhorse that extended and saved countless lives. Some people say, you know, it could extend even into the millions. So, for example, her chemo protocol for skin cancer alone increased survivability by 10 years. And, you know, a decade is a lifetime to these cancer survivors. So that's just one little footnote of what she's done. So I recommend you to read up and remember Jane Cook Wright. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing dacarazine, cyclophosphamide, or perhaps tetrahydrofolate.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Bob.
All chemo drugs.
Yeah. So, Kara, I understand that we may have to redraw the dinosaur family tree.
I know. This is a really exciting news item.
I just memorized the old one.
I kind of gasped when I first read about it, because like many probably of the listeners here, I'm dinosaur obsessed. If you've ever been to my home and visited my office, I have almost the complete Carnegie collection of scale model toy dinosaurs. I literally have hundreds of these little dinosaur toys all over my office. And now we have a different way to imagine their lineage. So here's a little bit of history, because I feel like we're not really going to be able to understand this story unless we understand the old way. Then we know how the new way relates to the old way. In 1887, there's a British paleontologist named Harry Seeley, and he lumped all the dinosaurs into two major groups. There were the saurischians and the ornithischians, and they were basically just divided based on the shape of their hips. So if you break down what the word means, you'll remember what's what. A saurischian is lizard-hipped, dinosaur, right? Tyrannosaur, terrible lizard, saurischian, lizard hip. And the ornithischians, ornitho, were bird-hipped. You could further divide it a little bit. So imagine these two big clades, saurischians, ornithischians, lizard-hipped, bird-hipped. You would then further divide the saurischians into the theropods and the sauropods. They're now actually called sauropodomorphs. But when I learned about it, the saurischians were the theropods and the sauropods. So here's some examples of all those kinds of dinosaurs. Theropods you might have heard of. I think that's a famous kind of one. That's like T-Rex. T-Rex is a theropod. Carnivorous, three-toed, eventually evolved to become birds. Sauropods, which originally were the other saurischian, are like the long-necked dinosaurs, Brontosaurus, Apatosaurus, Camarasaurus, all of those. The ornithischians, the other clade, were, and the bird-hipped dinosaurs, which did not evolve to become birds, which is confusing, were all of these other kind of catch-all dinosaurs that you often think of as being plant eaters that aren't the long-necked dinosaurs. So everything from Psittacosaurus, Parasaurolophus, Ankylosaur, Triceratops, all of these different dinosaurs that don't fit in those other two groups were the ornithischians.
But in that, Kara, the fact that that birds evolved from the saurischians always bothered the hell out of me.
Me too. It was one of the most confusing things for me to get past when I learned about paleontology in college, because by the time I went to college, we already knew that the bird lineage was there. We didn't know how strong it was, but we knew it was there. And we were just starting to understand that dinosaurs had feathers. And so I was like, what? Wait, what? Like, why would the So Tyrannosaurus, which is in the lineage that eventually became birds, was not bird-hipped. It's so confusing.
Yeah, it always made me think there was something wrong.
That's
an oversimplification. Yeah,
exactly.
It's not really lizard-hipped or bird-hipped. It's not based on actual homology.
No, but they are different enough. A lot of people do say that it's sort of always worked because you could pretty obviously look at a dinosaur hip and go like, yeah, I know what category it is without looking at anything else and also having all these preconceived notions. So Matthew Barron, he's a PhD student at Cambridge. And this is part of what I love about the story. This is his dissertation research. He's not even a professor yet. And this is getting so much news. So he's proposing a new way to classify these dinosaurs. What he did is he looked at 74 different species, early species, of both dinosaurs and dinosaur-like dinosaur-adjacent species from the Triassic and the early Jurassic, so some of the first dinosaurs. And he further looked at 457 individual characteristics of them, so a lot more than just the hip shape. He looked at all sorts of measurements. And he, based on this and based on using algorithmic data, this massive data set where he looked at different algorithms to try and fit them into a new tree, he proposes now that what used to be the saurischians, which used to be the theropods and the sauropods, now should only include the sauropods, the long-necked dinosaurs. And I'll get to another little thing that's added to it, but for the most part, only the sauropods. And then that the ornithischians, the bird-hipped ones, which used to only be ornithischians, should also include the theropods, which this would make everything better for you, Steve, because those eventually became birds. So that would mean that T-Rex had a more common ancestor with Triceratops, not with Apatosaurus. So is everybody kind of clear on the visual of this?
Yeah.
It's basically the theropods moved over from the saurischian clade to the ornithischian clade. That's basically what happened. But they got renamed.
Yeah, they renamed it. Ornithoceladians.
Ornithocelida. And we'll talk about that in a second.
Ornithoceladins, yeah.
Yeah. So here's
Which includes ornithischians and theropods.
Exactly. Yeah. So
interesting.
The reason that he looked at the dinosaurs he looked at, here's a quote from Ed Yong, who wrote a beautiful article about this in Atlantic. Ed Yong says, quote, if you collapse the entire reign of the dinosaurs into a single calendar year, icons like Tyrannosaurus and Triceratops only appeared after Christmas. Velociraptor was only alive in mid-December, and Stegosaurus and Diplodocus arose in early July. There are far fewer fossils from the first half of the dinosaurs' history in the Triassic and early Jurassic. And among the species from those pioneering millennia, the first dinosaurs, January through July, I just added that, the saurischians commanded most of the attention. The early ornithischians were seldom unearthed. So he wanted to look at these. We're basing all of these of this phylogenetic information on really, really evolved late dinosaurs. So he said, let's look at the early guys when they actually would have been splitting and when they would have had common ancestors, and let's see how they relate. So yeah, Barron wanted to study these early dinosaurs. He noticed that the early ornithischians, so again, we're talking about the same clade that has Triceratops and Parasaurolophus and Psittacosaurus, that clade, but the earliest versions in that clade, had a bunch of features in common with the theropods. And so when he noticed that, he started to rethink the entire structure, and he came up with a bunch of new conclusions based on this data. I love this. Okay, number one. The earliest dinosaurs may have derived 247 million years ago, not 231 to 243 million years ago, as previously thought. Earliest dinosaurs could have been even older than we thought. Number two, earliest dinosaurs may have come from Laurasia, which was in the northern hemisphere, not from Gondwana, which was in the southern hemisphere. So again, unearthing these notions that we already held that the earliest dinosaurs came from the south, could have come from the north. Number three, saurischia may have been comprised of the long-necked sauropodomorphs. So that's, Brontosaurus, Brachiosaurus, all of those guys. And ancient carnivores known as hererosaurids. This was really confusing. And if he relumps it this way, it could answer a lot of questions. Because hererosaurids look like theropods. And that may be why some of the earliest theropods got lumped in over with the sauropodomorphs. But if you only take this one lineage, this would be kind of a pure example, like we see all the time, of convergent evolution. We just happen to have some guys on this clade who look a little bit like theropods, but they're not. They're saurischia. So now we've got this saurischia being made up of sauropodomorphs, long-necked dinosaurs, and these early hererosaurids. Honestly, you've probably never heard of any of them. Hererosaurus, Kindosaurus, Caseosaurus, Staurikosaurus, not Staurakosaurus, and San Juanosaurus. They look like theropods, but otherwise we've not heard of them. And they have a lot of these early evolutionary traits. Okay, number four. Ornithischians and theropods may have come from a common ancestor comprising this new group that Barron, as you mentioned, Steve, is calling Ornithocelida. He didn't make up that word. Actually, Thomas Huxley made up that word because Thomas Huxley, way nice. Back in the day, believed theropods and ornithischians were related.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
Smart. He's even cooler than I thought he was.
I know. And Barron is...
Ahead of his time.
And Barron is super cool for knowing that and for bringing his word back
and
into vogue.
And for citing it.
Yes, I love that. Okay, so here's another quote from Ed Yong, which I think helps explain this further. Quote, unlike the distinctive bird hips of the ornithischians, there's no single character that distinguishes the ornithocelidans. Rather, they're characterized by a hodgepodge of at least 21 hard-to-define features. The first of them were probably small, agile, two-legged runners with large grasping hands and a varied diet. So what Barron argues is that there was this accepted notion in paleontology for years and years and years, decades, that dinosaurs began as carnivores, and eventually the ornithischians were like these oddballs out that evolved herbivorous tendencies. He's saying that's wrong. It's probably more likely that all early dinosaurs were omnivores. They were opportunists. It was an incredibly hard time to be alive, and they ate whatever they could to stay alive. And then the theropods and the hererosaurids convergently evolved carnivorous diets. It's much more likely that a diet of meat could be evolved among multiple lineages than some of these other traits that seem to be much more conserved. Okay, so just a couple more things. Another change that Barron's research suggests, so this would be number, I guess, five. The earliest dinosaurs could have had feathers. And some people have posited that all dinosaurs started with a feathered ancestor. We now know that most theropods had feathers. You know, T-Rex had feathers, and of course, Archaeopteryx had feathers, and Velociraptor had feathers, all those good guys. And they eventually evolved to become birds. But some ornithischians had feathers as well, like Psittacosaurus, and that didn't seem to make sense with the current clades. But if now theropods and ornithischians share a common lineage, perhaps they had a common ancestor. Their oldest ancestor did too. That means that the saurischians, along with the hererosauridae, are just on their own. And that would explain why they never evolve feathers, instead of this weird explanation that some paleontologists have had to come up with, that all dinosaurs had a feathered ancestor and then the saurischians lost feathers. It would make much more sense if feathers were a specific ornithocelidan trait and it only evolved along that clade. So it's just another kind of, that sort of makes sense with this new lineage. So there is a skeptical quote. There's always a skeptical quote in every good article. This one comes from Steve Broussat from the University of Edinburgh. He says, I wouldn't start rewriting the textbooks just yet. This is just one analysis, and lots of recent studies recovered the more traditional grouping. Since this new result contradicts such a vast legacy of research, I think the bar should be high. And I fully agree. Interestingly, so many paleontologists are not rattled by this. They're not angry by it. They're fascinated and gripped and can't wait to see where it goes. And that could be the beginning of an exciting paradigm shift in paleontology. Could be that it doesn't pan out. We'll have to see a lot more research to decide. But either way, this is definitely one of those paleontology stories that's like newsworthy. It's exciting.
Yeah, I agree. It is. It's one paper, so it's not.
It is one paper,
yet, but there's a lot. There's a lot about it that's very compelling.
Yes, and it's the most intense analysis ever done because we never had the computing power to do what he did until now. Nobody's ever looked at that many species and that many characteristics and used computing power to try and come up with a new lineage. So for that reason too, it's intriguing at the very least.
Well, Kara, I'm going to be talking about a dinosaur related item as well.
Ooh.
Other than yourself, right, Steve?
Yeah, because I'm also a dinosaurophile. Bob's Yay. Older than I am. Let's remind you of that.
Bob's the fossil.
Bob's the oldest one on the show.
Steve loves to remind Bob.
Bobosaurus came before Stevosaurus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but Bob, the funny story here, Kara, you might not know this, mm-hmm. is that we were at a conference and somebody thought that Steve was Bob and my father.
No. Oh, that's no.
Like as in... Oh, Steve's your dad, right?
Steve, what did Steve do? I have to know this.
Oh, Steve is an expert at holding his emotions at bay. I'm sure he was screaming on the inside. Whatever, he didn't do anything. We just laughed about it.
He sent you and Bob to your rooms.
Yeah.
Seriously, that ship has sailed so long ago. I went gray in my 30s.
That's honestly kind of, the only reason why. It's because you went gray.
Yeah, that's why. It's because I'm gray.
That's absolutely why. Yeah. But and you know, you're the neurologist. You carry yourself as the neurologist for sure. I think if put in a lineup and given a few sentences to speak, I think most people would pick you out of the lineup as the neurologist in the group.
Probably. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about one branch of dinosaurs that evolved mm-hmm. into birds, so which come from the theropods.
Mm-hmm. Which may now be ornithoscelidans.
There we go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Change all the notes.
All fitting together. So this is a recent paper about one new specimen. It's not a new – I think it's the second specimen of this species, Eo Confuciusornis. Eo meaning dawn, right? So this is – there's Confuciusornis, and this is Eo Confuciusornis, which came before Confuciusornis. So this is the oldest – fossil bird species with a beak.
Okay.
That has a bird beak. But what's cool about this specimen is that it has exceptional preservation of soft tissue. So they were able to actually examine the skin of this early bird. And this comes pretty close to the base of the branch that led to modern birds, you know.
Yep.
To back up a little bit, as we now know that the theropod dinosaurs were all feathered.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently at the Peabody Museum and they have a feathered dinosaur wing now, which is awesome. And they show like all of the feathered theropods, like
double entendre.
From T-Rex. Yeah. T-Rex to, you know, Velociraptor, all those guys. And they're just amazing. In addition to that, there was this amazing adaptive radiation where these small bird-like theropod dinosaurs who had feathers and were evolving different kinds of wings and clearly using them differently, most not to fly, a couple of different branches to fly. One branch had four wings instead of two wings. It's all Ooh. Cool. Yeah, all over the place. And one of those branches led to birds, right? So it isn't this one linear sequence. We always like to point out that evolution is bushy. There's lots of bushes going in all directions. They didn't know they were evolving into birds. They were just evolving in every which way. And again, one happened to eventually develop into birds. But what's really interesting about bird evolution is that, you know, it definitely was this thing where these species hit upon this very different way of surviving, you know, flying. And flying is very high energy, but is massively advantageous. If you could pull it off, if you could be a good flyer, the advantages in terms of locomotion, hunting, escaping predators, etc., is just massive.
Oh, yeah.
Well, think of that ability for a second. I mean, you know, there's so many little different ways you could adapt to your environment, but figuring out how to fly, that's like, it's a different universe of possibilities and
for sure.
Almost anything.
And pterosaurs, interestingly enough, not birds and also not dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs.
Did you know were the first to have that niche? They were the first vertebrate animals to be able to fly.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's so cool.
But also, it is a game changer, but it also puts an incredible amount of selective pressures on the species, right?
Mm.
So a lot of little changes happen when you start to fly. A lot of anatomical changes happen.
Like what, Steve?
Well, before you even go there, I think the key thing, though, is to for people to understand is that even if you are the crappiest flyer on the planet, you are still flying, and it's still incredibly advantageous.
Oh, sure. Yeah, being an absolutely crappy flyer is a massive advantage. Even if all you're doing is slowing your descent to the ground. Or gliding.
Yeah, even gliding. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But my point is – that this gives us a real opportunity in terms of demonstrating evolution in action, because so many anatomical changes were happening over this period of time, and they are adaptations for flight. Now, of course, modern birds have the full suite, right? At least that exists now. Who knows what will be in the future? But, you know, if we use modern birds as our now in hindsight known endpoint, birds have a lot of adaptations for flight in terms of the shape of their breastbone, for the attachment of their breast muscles, the feathers themselves, the anatomy of the feathers, the shape of their tail.
And their hollow bones.
Yeah, although the hollow bones are, I think, ubiquitous among theropods.
So gotcha.
That predated flight.
But it really helped that they're so light.
Yeah, but you know what? That's interesting. That's that people think, oh, yeah, hollow bones, they're light, and that's why they're advantageous for flying. Mm-hmm. But actually, they're not that much lighter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, the real adaptation, you know why they're hollow?
Oh, because of those air bladder things?
Air?
They have air sacs in them. They're breathing through their bones. They're exchanging oxygen. So it
why?
Enables them.
How's that help?
Because,
more surface area?
Because you have more oxygen. And because flying is high energy. They need the oxygen to be able to fly, to be able to do something so energetic.
Second, it's like if we were constantly on a treadmill all day, every day.
Yeah.
How does that work? How the hell do they get air in and out of their bones fast?
They have sacs that hold the air inside their bodies.
Like little lungs?
Sort yeah, little air sac.
Pockets.
Yeah, like little bladders.
What? Why am I just hearing about this now?
Birds are fascinating.
Seriously, though, how much air are birds and their tiny bones going to actually have?
It's a ratio.
Apparently it matters. It has a physiological effect.
I don't think it matters.
Bob's a denier. Bob's a air sac denier.
Super established science.
Bob's an air sac denier. You're a filthy denier, Bob.
Yeah, Bob.
All right. I believe they're there, but I just think the relative volumes is shit.
See, this is where
just saying
this is interesting because I'm having that like I don't believe it moment, right?
Yeah,
you know, I can utterly override it in my brain because that's what I've been training myself to do.
But I love how what you don't believe is such a small, it's like not even the point of like what Steve's talking about.
Well, that's because we have heard our whole lives that birds have hollow bones so that they're light so they can
exactly
fly.
I just made that mistake. Yes.
Yeah, it's just not true. They're actually, the theropods have hollow bones. They don't make them that much more lighter, but they do allow for an extra surface area for oxygen exchange, and that's probably the real advantage to them.
Makes sense.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you guys know what patagia are?
Patagia. I know what petechia is.
I had a cream, got rid of it.
What? Okay. Steve, you just made that up.
No.
And patina.
Birds have loose skin flaps that increase the surface area of their wings and help them fly. Also, so their wings are not just comprised of feathers, they're also comprised of these three skin flaps, very similar to bats and pterosaurs.
And
right?
Pterosaurs, because they didn't have wings at all. They were all skin.
Not as extensive because they have feathers, but they do have these extra skin flaps that help, you know, their surface area.
I want to see a bird then without feathers.
You've seen a chicken or a turkey, right? You can see them there. You can actually see them. They're tucked under.
Bob, think of your chicken wing. There's a flap of skin, right, between the wrist and the shoulder.
I just eat breasts.
All right. So
you're right, Steve.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's the propatagium, which is the flap of skin that connects the shoulder to the wrist. You could see that when you're eating your chicken wings. There's the postpatagium, which is a flap of skin that extends off the back of the hand. And then there is the allular patagium, which is the flap of skin connecting the first digit to the rest of the hand. Mm. So these skin flaps comprise part of the wing. These are additional little adaptations that birds evolved to make them better flyers. So just like all these other anatomical features that birds have, we can follow these detailed anatomical structures throughout bird evolution. The problem is the patagia are soft tissue.
Yeah.
So we needed an exceptional preservation of soft tissue, which is what we just got in Io Confuciusornis. It's at the pretty close now to the base of the bird lineage. So we could say, aha, we could look at the skin and we'll know something about the evolution of patagia in birds. And guess what they found? They found that the Io confuciusornis had the pro-patagium and the post-patagium, but not the allular patagium.
Neat.
It had two of the three, but not the third. Gee, like exactly what you would expect. Not in those specific details, but the fact that it had some, but not all, of the adaptations for flight fits so well, right, into the evolutionary narrative.
Yeah, show me one patagium, though.
So is this guy, that narrative. What's his name again? Io
Confuciusornis.
How
I like that name.
Io Confuciusornis, is he a more recent ancestor than, for example, Archaeopteryx?
So Archaeopteryx is a side branch. It's not in the line for birds.
But it's the most recent split off, right? That we know
probably,
of.
Yeah, it's probably the most recent
proto-bird.
Off of living birds, yeah.
You're right. Because it has so many bird-like features, even though it never fully...
Yeah,
continued.
It's like, I love Archaeopteryx because it's basically half bird, half theropod. Yeah.
I still call it a dinosaur. Some people call it a bird. Some people call it a dinosaur. You're right. It never evolved to become bird. So, but the cutoff is so like wiggly at that point.
Yeah. I mean, so Archaeopteryx can fly, but it was a shitty flyer.
Yeah.
It didn't have a lot of these little anatomical adaptations to flight. It probably could not take off from the ground like birds could. It couldn't do that wing flip maneuver that birds can do. It had teeth. It had a long bony tail. I mean, it really was a theropod dinosaur with wings.
It's tattooed on my forearm.
I know.
The Berlin specimen.
The Berlin specimen is my favorite fossil.
It's so good. Because it's such a beautiful fossil.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's iconic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The wings are spread out, almost angelic. The head is in that death curl, back.
Yeah. I love that.
Arcing backwards.
And I always say,
I love
when people say, why do you have that dead bird-like thing on your forearm? I'm like, this is my cute creationist. That's what I have right here. It's such an iconic, what they call, what do they call them? The intermediate fossils. Yeah. Such an iconic, although now we know it didn't actually lead to birds.
Well, it's quote unquote transitional because it fills in the morphological space between birds and dinosaurs.
You're right. It has half and half, basically.
Because let's face it, no single fossil that we have is an actual ancestor to living groups. Even if they might be the tiniest little side branch, but they probably, there probably isn't an unbroken chain from them to living creatures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It would be remarkable coincidence if we happened to get those particular specimens. Everything is a cousin, right? Everything is a side branch. It's only a matter of how much.
And so everything is also like an intermediary. And like everything's a cousin and a side branch, but it's also all incremental. Like you can never be like, well, what's the one in between? It's like, there's so many.
Nope.
There's never going to be just one.
More than you'll ever know.
So when we say transitional, it's more of just, it's somewhere in that big branching mess in between these two other big branching messes. But you could, you know what I mean? So
It's like Australopithecus. Like we didn't directly evolve from that, but it's in our lineage.
Yeah, though that recent... We did the Homo genus evolved from the Australopithecus genus.
Mm-hmm. But Australopithecus afarensis did not become.
We don't know.
We don't know. It could have just died.
Yeah.
It's so hard to know.
But what's cool is, so like you could take all of the feathered dinosaurs and you could say, oh, this was the first incidence of hollow cylindrical feathers. And over here, tufted feathers. And over here, the semilunate carpal in the hand. And over here, asymmetrical feathers. And then here, now we could say, the patagia show up here. So like it's all incremental, right? Over time, these bird adaptations, these modern bird adaptations are appearing in these feathered dinosaurs.
That makes sense, right? The order makes sense.
The order makes sense.
Less complex it's not more complex to less. It makes sense.
Yeah.
You're adding and continually refining.
But it also makes it that much harder for people to get past that kind of very human error that we make, which is that evolution is somehow guided. Right? Because it just seems just working towards flight. It had no interest in flight. It had all these other reasons for happening.
Yeah, but the adaptive radiation, they're going in every which direction totally belies that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, actually.
It's not linear. It is, they're evolving in every different direction.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, all over the place. So It's very. This is fascinating because when we were teenagers, right? Not you, Kara, but like the rest of us, we were. Archaeopteryx was the only really transitional species of bird.
Right.
That was it. We had theropods,
Archaeopteryx,
and modern, and maybe early birds, but basically, you know, fully developed modern birds. And now, whatever, just in the last 20 years or so, we have this incredible assemblage of feathered dinosaurs. And we discovered that the theropods were feathered. Mm-hmm. We have thousands of specimens. It's just we found a couple of...
Thank you, China.
Yeah, well...
yeah, seriously.
Oh, yes. Mostly China.
If you read the report, they talk about having a very important taphonomic window. Have you ever heard that? Taphonomic.
Oh, yeah,
window.
Taphonomy. Didn't I cover that word?
Yes, we did. Taphonomy is a study of what happens to things after they die.
Yeah.
And so a taphonomic window means that there's this layer of dirt, you know, that is dates to a certain time and place. And so it's a window into that point in our history. So in that part of the world at this time, birds were evolving all over the place, and we're just digging up thousands of fossils of feathered dinosaurs and early birds and bird and related bird species. It's amazing. It is to me now perhaps the single most dramatic example of the predictive power of evolutionary theory. When Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, we didn't even have Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx was discovered about 10 years or so after The Origin of Species, the Berlin
or
specimen.
DNA for that.
Yeah,
or that DNA.
Too.
That's true.
But then somebody said, hey, you know, the bottom line is the big group birds has to be related to some other big group, so we should find fossils somewhere to connect birds to some other major group that they evolved from. And then we found Archaeopteryx. It became pretty clear that they were evolved from reptiles, probably dinosaurs, probably theropod dinosaurs. And now we have thousands of specimens filling in that space, exactly what should exist if evolution occurred. And if creationism were true, there's absolutely no reason for any of these fossils to exist. That's the bottom line. And and this was something that was predicted by evolutionary theory, that this kind
of thing.
That's
the best part.
Yeah, we needed to be discovered, and we did. And it actually exceeded what I think anybody could possibly have imagined. You know, the feathered dinosaurs and the early birds were a remarkably successful clade. You know, much more, I think, than anybody anticipated. So this
and of course, modern birds are incredibly successful. If you think about, you know, millions of years from now, if an anthropologist alien were to look at our fossil record, there'd be so many freaking birds.
Yeah. They're so very successful because flying is a really good adaptation.
Yeah.
And they don't have that much competition in the skies. It's true. There's a few mammals. There's like one, you know, one type
there's
of mammal
bats.
That flies.
Yeah.
Yeah, just bats. I mean, there's a lot of species, but still, that's it. They pretty much own the skies.
Yeah. Very, very incredible. I'm endlessly fascinated by it. All right.
Cool.
Jay, tell us about Elon Musk's latest, venture.
I like how you put that.
That was almost like Steve had a little problem with the guy.
Well,
I personally love him. I think he's awesome.
You love him.
Without a doubt. Aww.
Man crush.
Doubt the man
is
a visionary.
He's too afraid of AIs.
Well, let's talk about it, Bob. That's what we like to do on the show. And I actually am really curious to see what you guys really think about this. So I see him as a tenacious and able to force very hard ideas and things into reality type of person. I mean, you know, think about what he did. He started SpaceX and Tesla as an example. These are not easy things to do. You have to have vision. You have to have massive drive.
Money.
Fortitude, money, nerve, right, to start companies like this. I mean, think about it. I want to start a space agency. I mean, you don't just pull that idea out of your butt.
Right.
I mean, you have to be somebody to do that. So, yeah, and he has to be intelligent.
But also a little crazy.
Of course. Of course. You have to be kind of out there to, I think.
Maybe not Howard Hughes crazy, but.
I think most important, though, someone like Elon Musk has to be correct a lot. He has to, like, say things and think of things that are right, that are correct, in order for them to take shape in reality. You know, he's not forcing nonsense into the world. He's bringing, you know, out ideas. And his ideas have to be correct or his spaceships won't land, you know, or his, you know, his ideas won't work. So. You know, I realize that when I scroll through the things I've read about him, you know, I do like the way this guy thinks, and I do trust his judgment to a degree. You know, I don't know him personally, but I read a lot about him, and I usually go, hey, yeah, that's a cool idea, and I kind of agree with that. So I do give him a pretty good dose of trust when I read things that he said. And as an example, like Elon believes that we need to spread humanity to the other planets, or another, you know, Mars as an example, to protect our race from disaster. Elon Musk has some interesting ideas about artificial intelligence. Should we develop it? And if we do develop it, you know, what? How should we handle it? How should we deal with the fact that it is inevitable, right? It's probably coming soon. I mean, it could be here within a decade or 20 years. You know,
nah.
It's within
reach.
Well,
it depends on how you define it, because some artificial intelligence is already here.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, let's draw a line in the sand and say, you know, we're talking about something that rivals the human brain or is more powerful than the human brain. So within 50 years, we'll put a nice marker.
Algorithmically.
50
years
out there.
Yeah, okay,
yeah, but Jay, you are talking about self-aware general AI.
And you have to, I think a lot even of techno-optimists are starting to make a distinction between what we would call intellectual processing power and cognitive power.
Right. Yeah, you're
that
right.
We might have AI that has processing power that we might even be able to define as intelligent, but not cognitive aware or conscious.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
it's going to be, it's possible that there's going to be like all these shades of gray, like, you know, it might not be conscious like as we understand conscious, and it might be hazy like a child's mind. They're not really fully grasping what's going on around them, but they are conscious. You know, we don't know. Yeah, I agree. It's going to, we could spend an hour just trying to put rails on this thing, but let's just, for broad brushstrokes, let's say somewhere on the spectrum of self-awareness and some type of consciousness, but really like talking about the processing power and its capabilities that could be equal to or more than a human. That's what I really think we're talking about here, because whether it's conscious or not, we may never even really know. There might not be tests that are good enough to really, really ever know, but I think we can easily detect how intelligent an AI could be and what it's capable of, right?
Yeah, and in some aspects, we're seeing daily examples of it beating humans, or beating right. us at poker and beating us at chess and being better at diagnosing things. And you know, we have each new little example.
It's just tiny slices of intelligence, so it's
exactly.
really nothing close.
Yeah, it's focus. It's like they're all like savants. Like we have a bunch of artificial savants.
Yep.
But to me, that's the most reassuring thing, because what I think is what that's showing us is that we don't need to make AI self-aware. It could do everything we needed to do without anything approaching self-awareness, just by being good at driving cars or playing chess or whatever we needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
so why would we? Why would we make it self-aware when we don't need it to be self-aware? It could be really powerful AI and do exactly what it wanted to do, and you don't have to worry about it wanting anything or
maybe.
Thinking anything.
Yeah. Maybe.
Tool rather than an entity.
But Steve, that might be true. We might be able to have it be like, well, you can't tell the difference, and it's not conscious.
That is true now. What I'm saying is that's exactly what we have now, and I think we're learning how powerful that approach could be, that non-self-aware but AI approach. And therefore, what that tells me is we will never need to make AI self-aware.
Well, that's, right. Yeah, but that doesn't mean self-awareness is the only route to our extinction. I mean, you could still have, you could still create an immensely intelligent program with a fitness function that wipes us out because we're part of the problem.
Well, that's so, what I was just saying.
Is that because it's been compromised, Bob, or it develops
Musk said himself, you create a program that wants to destroy all spam, get rid of spam, and it decides, oh, well, humans create spam, I'll get rid of humans, therefore spam will go away. Just the unintended consequences.
Right,
that's
but Bob, you said wants and decides. No, I'm saying we don't need AI that will want or decide anything. It'll do exactly what the F we tell it to do, and it won't be deciding anything.
Right, it'll just be running its program and
Steve,
wiping us out.
That's you in your own paradigm. Like you're saying, yeah, we could do it, but what you know, Elon is saying, and this is true, this is happening, people are trying to make conscious machines.
No, they're not. No one's even anywhere close to making a conscious
machine.
Steve,
they might not be close, but people have designs on that. They want to do it. There are a lot of people out there that want artificial intelligence. What do you mean, who?
Jay, I'm disagreeing with you. I don't think there's any researcher out there who was working specifically on developing self-awareness. They're developing AI like driving a self-driving car types of AI that do tasks, that do stuff, that do pattern recognition or big data number crunching or whatever. But there's, first of all, with regular computers, they have no potential to be artificially intelligent, in my opinion.
I'm with you on that.
I don't agree.
Neuromorphic chips like we talked about last week. If you develop neuromorphic types of chips, something like that, then you could, I think, potentially get to
Silicon AI. Well, there you go. Neuromorphic chips.
But no one's using them to make a self-aware AI. They're using them to do pattern recognition.
But Steve, what Elon is saying, and I think it's a legitimate flag to raise, is that in the pursuit to get more intelligent machines and the probable time frame or the probable outcome of somebody actually making a conscious machine, we have to be extraordinarily careful. That's essentially what he's saying. So what you're saying might be right.
I understand that. I would not say that we're close to it, that anybody's working on it. I don't think that anyone needs to ever be working on it. But yes, it's possible that at some point, 50 or 100 years from now or whatever, somebody may, for whatever reason, decide that they want to make a computer that is self-aware, and we'd need to think about and deal with that. But it doesn't have to happen. That would require a deliberate developmental program of research, and we could just decide not to do it because you know why? We're perfectly happy with the non-self-aware AI. It's doing everything we want it to do.
The problem is that there's always going to be someone out there somewhere who wants to try something just because they can.
Yeah, like Dr. Evil.
Yeah, well, seriously, like we might be able to regulate the shit out of it in America, and we might decide as a culture and a society that it's not what we want, but there may always be some. And I agree with you, Steve. I think that techno-optimists think that we know way more about the brain than we do and think that we are way closer to some sort of singularity moment than we are, if it's even possible. But that said, if we ever got to that point, there's always going to be someone somewhere who's doing this seedy work. Because they want to prove that they can, and they want to say they were the first to do it.
Steve, I'm going to put my coin down here. I don't agree with everything that you're saying.
Okay.
I really absolutely believe, and I'm going to, as soon as we're done with the show, I'm going to immediately start looking for proof to back up what I'm about to say. No, I'll admit if I'm wrong. I'm just saying my sense and my aggregate gut right now is telling me there are people out there like Ray Kurzweil seems to be one of them that wants the singularity to happen. And to me, the singularity is about real artificial intelligence, like an explosion of artificial intelligence. So, look, it's an interesting thing to talk about. And again, we could do more research to really dig in and maybe we should absolutely talk to people that are in the field and get a perspective from people that know, like the top 100 scientists that are doing this. We could do that. And I think we should, because, I think it'll color this conversation a bit, because if you're right, Steve, and they're really not thinking, hey, we're going to get to a real artificial thinking conscious machine someday, I'll be surprised, and I'll absolutely take you out to dinner and tell you I was wrong about it. But God forbid you're wrong, you're going to pay dearly. Okay, so but let me continue, because this story is a lot more interesting. There's more stuff to talk about here. So Elon, in his belief that, hey, we got to be careful, and look, there seems to be companies that are out there that are trying to achieve artificial intelligence. Could we please get real about this? He has an interesting way of kind of dealing with it. So he says that, he is backing a company called Neuralink, and they're working on a brain-to-computer interface. Now, this isn't like, hey, I want to control things on my computer. This is a real interface that goes into your brain that is a cyborg. You're a cyborg at that point. They're putting computer components into your brain to interface with your brain. So controlling a limb, someone lost their arm and they have ways of detecting the muscle or maybe even reading nerve activity. But how about your brain directly telling the limb to do things, or interfacing with software, having some type of way to go from analog to digital. This is all pretty profound, and somebody's got to start a company or several companies that are going to be working on this thing.
There's also a company called Kernel who's working on this.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
There's lots of groups working on it. Yeah.
So Musk thinks that we need to keep pace with artificial intelligence by merging with machines on some level, right? So before you pass judgment, consider that Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking are also concerned about humanity's future entanglements with AI, right? So two other people that, you know, I highly respect all three of them for numerous reasons. There are other visionaries out there that I respect, but they're on the other side. So we have like Larry Page, who's one of the founders of Google. I already mentioned Ray Kurzweil. And Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, you know, for all the guys, you know, the guy's achieved an enormous amount, and he is an entrepreneur, and he is behind developing artificial intelligence. I mean, they want to fully embrace AI, and these people think that this is the next step for humanity, which I agree in some way or form of that statement. I do think that that's true. They also seem to think that we don't really have anything to worry about. And I would say no matter what we do, no matter how what we're developing, like Steve was like, look, let's not even cook it in. Let's just make it so these are discrete systems that are really good at one thing, and maybe they don't need any level of consciousness, and we could still get really far with that. If that's true, I would agree, Steve. Let's err on the side of not creating consciousnesses. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, we know what side of the argument Steve is on. So what do you guys think? I want to hear from everyone. Like, give me a definitive answer.
I don't want to put a line in the sand and say it's not possible, but it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that we even will be able to do that, because we still don't understand at the neurological level the source, the full source of consciousness. We don't understand that transitional point where brain activity becomes consciousness.
Right.
And modeling it with a computer is just not good enough. We have to fully understand it. And so that's where I would say that the few companies that are, quote, trying to do what we're talking about doing are actually these interesting places where neuroscientists are coming together, researchers in the neurosciences are coming together with computer scientists. Actually, I think their original goal is to map network level interaction. Because they think that once they can map network level interaction, they can use that information that they're learning from neuroscience and apply it to their computational studies. But I'm sort of in the camp of like, it's an eye roll sometimes when people come to me and they say, oh, the singularity is going to happen in 10 years and look at Moore's law and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's not about that. We still don't understand the brain. Just because we can process a lot of things on a computer doesn't mean that we understand consciousness. And it's not just going to happen as a side prod, like a side effect of mass computational power. It's just not.
Yeah,
I think
I
it's
agree.
A gestalt thing. There's a gestalt thing to consciousness. It's not just, it's the sum is greater than the Or the whole yeah, is greater than the sum
that.
Of the parts.
I totally get what you're saying. I mean, I don't disagree with that at all. I still, though, that being said, you know, it doesn't mean, like Steve was saying, you know, there are computer chips that are being designed to behave and function in an analog style like neurons, right? So they could be they could build a brain. Like, we can't do it today because it's, you know, the size of the computer would be fantastically huge, and it would be incredibly costly to power the thing.
That's why I say I don't want to sit here and say it's impossible. But what I will say is, of course, we should be concerned, but we shouldn't freak out. We should deal with this the same way we do. There are other things that are way more possible right now. Look at CRISPR. We got to talk about regulation around CRISPR. That's a much more immediate issue that could have really amazing consequences and really detrimental consequences.
I agree, but
just
Kara,
like with
we
all
can't,
science.
We can't, you know, got to be careful when, you know, we can't just pick, you know, one of the potential danger spots in front of us. We really do need the AI experts that are working on it to help us figure out what the right path forward is there.
I agree, but I do. You would say, though, would you agree with me that people are overly obsessed with this one area? That they really think that this is their eschatology. The end of the world is going to come because of AI.
Well, okay, I don't disagree. I agree, and I think because sci-fi, you know, going back decades, you know, we love it. We clicked onto this, and it's part of our culture now. I mean, you know,
it's a viable existential threat. It's just a matter of when, you know.
It is. It's just I think that sometimes the existential threat is drawn to be out of proportion with other legitimate existential threats that are more recent.
Kara's saying they didn't make, you know, they made Skynet, and everybody knows who the Terminator is, but they didn't.
but that's a good example, though, because That's the whole science fiction behind Skynet becoming self-aware. That's bullshit. That's the 1950s naive, you know, sense that if a computer just becomes smart enough and fast enough and powerful enough, it'll wake up. But that's not going to happen. Yeah, that's why they thought in the 1950s, they really thought by the 1990s or by the turn of the century, we would have artificial intelligence. And we're really no closer now. I mean, you know, self-awareness. We're not any closer now than we were 50 years ago because we were completely on the wrong track because the computer architecture is not even heading in that direction.
Right.
So now we're thinking, okay, we'll make neuromorphic chips and maybe we'll think in 50 years that will be self-aware. And
it's
then
the
we'll
same
find
fallacy.
Out 50 years from now, that we're on that we're not doing something that we would need to be doing to make self-awareness. So we just don't know. We just are not even close enough to know how long it's going to take.
I don't disagree with that either, Steve. My point was that we never made movies about the biological angle, like we better watch out for technologies like CRISPR someday. Like, you know, Gattaca was about as close as it comes and it really didn't even get there. Like it kind of talks about what society would be like, but you know, but Kara's right. CRISPR, man, they could make they could easily construct a virus or a bacteria that could wipe out populations. It's within reach. That's now. That's
scarier.
That's way scarier. And to your point, you're right. I think the reason that people are obsessed with AI is because people are obsessed with stories. And we are really, really affected by cultural storytelling. And these
science
kinds of stories
has kind of poisoned us.
Dominate sci-fi. Yeah. Absolutely.
But let me summarize my position.
Summarize your point. Summarize.
I love it.
Let me summarize my position, Jay. So I think eventually, we will develop fully self-aware artificial intelligence. That will happen eventually. I think it's going to take longer than people think, just like it's already been taking longer than people think it will take. I think in the next 50 to 100 years, it will take a deliberate program that we'd have to go out of our way to make it happen, and we could just not do it. By the time we get to the point that some guy somewhere is going to do it, the technology is that accessible, you're pushing it even farther into the future. And by that time, I think that through things like Neuralink and other technological advances, that it's going to be a completely different game.
Yeah, you're saying it might almost be moderately irrelevant at that point.
By the time we get to the technology where fully self-aware AI is inevitable, I think we will have so merged with digital technology or whatever that it's
we'll all
matter.
Be augmented. We'll have augmented reality chips and all these things will be normal for us.
You guys are ignoring the potential usefulness of an intelligence explosion. That's something that humanity won't easily go into that. Who's gonna want to, you know, to iterate themselves, and totally come out the other end? Something that's certainly not human. That the appeal, the allure of something like that is eventually when the science is good enough, when the technology is good enough, it's going to happen at some point. It could take a while, yes, but I do not buy for a second that people are gonna be like, we don't need it. You know, the super specialized AI zombie tools will be awesome, but the draw for something like a self-aware entity that's purely digital, just from that basis alone, is going to be too tempting, and it will be done. They're not going to say, forget it. Who wants it?
Are you saying a market essentially is going to emerge for this kind of technology?
Oh yeah, I think it will.
Oh my God. Dude, right now, you look at if you go and look at the 50 business plans that are being drawn up for new companies, about 80% or 90% involve AI in one way or another. It is huge.
Right. Not self-aware AI.
I know, but I'm just saying, it's still being called AI. It's a super specialized zombie AI, whatever.
It's on the spectrum, Steve.
It's the beginning. It's its own
word. It isn't on the spectrum.
Charles.
Jay, my point is, it's not on the spectrum.
Says you, and we already agreed that we will talk about.
Says the neuroscientist.
Yes,
that's the important part.
Two neuroscientists on the show.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of either of you two. I'll take that. So
listen, my point is, Bob and Jay.
Make his point. This will be fun.
My thinking on this has evolved over time because I was with you 10, 15 years ago. But, you know, the more I've thought about it, the more I've realized, well, shit, We don't have to make these things self-aware in order to do everything we want them to do. So the incentive to do it, I think, is a lot less. We may get to that point in 40 or 50 years where we're like, why the frick are we going to make this thing self-aware? That's only going to cause problems and it's going to have no advantage. Why right. even
what are
do
the advantages?
It?
Steve, yeah. I don't disagree. If we can get there, sure, of course. It's the best safety
that.
Measure. But Bob and I are saying, and I think I can reduce it down to a sentence. We're saying that it's probably likely that it's going to happen because people
anyway.
Don't care what you think, Steve. They don't care. They're going to want to get there. They're going to want to create
What's
artificial
the impetus?
Intelligence. Because it's like literally saying, I got to the top of Mount Everest. Why the hell would you want to do that?
But
Why
what we're saying is that okay, luckily for us, that is so far in the future.
Hoskinen, yeah, right.
It's not happening in our lifetime.
It doesn't happen by a person just walking up a hill, James Bob. It
we
it
know.
Takes forces.
I agree.
The society has to want it to happen. Necessity, right? It has to be a product of necessity. And there is no necessity for it.
My point is they will want it just for one reason. To create a life form that's not organic.
That's like saying I want to make a virus that'll potentially kill everybody.
Well, we already did that, though, Evan.
A virus that can potentially kill everybody.
My ex-wife proves that there's non-organic life.
We have already done that. It's called synthetic biology. It's not like you need AI to make artificial biology. To make sentient artificial biology, you would.
That's what my implication is.
But Look, that implication is like even more far in the future.
Yeah. I guess it's the three of you guys. So Kara, Steve, and Evan, though, can you see where Bob and I are saying? We're not like, we absolutely want, you know, conscious artificial intelligence. What we're saying is it seems like there's going to be, if there isn't right now, there will be a very strong motivation for a company or groups of people that want to achieve it for the sake of achieving it.
And my main point is that what the last 10, 15 years has shown us is that we don't need self-awareness in order to get AIs
right.
to do what we want. I think the motivation to make a self-aware AI has diminished dramatically and it may vanish entirely. Right. That's my main point. Okay, Evan, can dogs smell breast cancer or what?
Well, it depends on what you read and who you speak to and who you listen to. Well, but it leads us to the news item this week, courtesy of the agency France Presse. They report that dogs can sniff out cancer from a piece of cloth which had touched the breast of a woman with a tumor. And this was announced by researchers recently, announcing the results as an unusual but promising diagnostic trial conducted by a nonprofit called K-Dog. Now, K-Dog describes themselves as, and I quote, a canine cancer-based cancer screening research program using a reliable, reproducible, non-invasive, and inexpensive method that offers an alternative to first-line mammography.
I don't buy it.
Yeah, I don't buy it either.
Interesting. I've got a lot to say about this one.
Yeah. Well, here's the gist of it. Here was their experiment they did. With just 6 months of training, a pair of German shepherds became 100% accurate in their new role as breast cancer spotters. Isabel Fromentin, who leads the project K-Dog, she had told the journalists that the reason why they were researching this is to come up with cheap and non-invasive means for cancer detection, especially to be used in countries where mammograms are very difficult to come by. That in these countries, there are oncologists, there are surgeons, but in rural areas, often there is limited access to diagnostics. So that's sort of their purpose behind doing this. Now, working on the assumption that breast cancer cells have a distinguishing smell, which sensitive dog noses can pick up, the team collected samples from 31 cancer patients. There were pieces of bandages that the patients had held against their affected breast. The team trained two German shepherds to recognize cancerous rags from non-cancerous ones. And they said that it's all based on game playing and reward, according to the canine specialist. So right there, I think that's a red flag unto itself.
No, I don't think it is, but I'll tell you
don't?
That later.
Oh, okay. Well, I do.
Absolutely not.
We'll come back to this. I want to give you the results and then we can talk about it.
Yeah.
So 6 months, dogs were put to the test over several days earlier this year. The researchers used, again, 31 bandages from different cancer patients. Now, one bandage was used per experiment along with three samples from women with no cancer. So you had one positive, three negatives, essentially. So you had four choices. Each of the four bandages was, bandages were placed in a box with a large cone in which the dogs could stick their snouts into them, sniffing each one. So four boxes per test and a round of 31 times. First time around, the dogs detected 28 out of the 31 cancerous bandages, which was 90%. And then they did it again. They did a whole second trial. Then they scored 100%.
And yeah, but how many false positives did they have?
Exactly, right.
Oh, they didn't report that?
No, it wasn't reported.
No, but what I think they did was, I had that same question, but what I think they did is they had one cancerous and three non-cancerous, mm-hmm. and they if they sat down in front of the one that was cancerous, they scored that as a hit.
Yeah, but what if they sat down in front of one that was non-cancerous? Well, that's what I'm saying.
Well, that's where is it 100% means they never did. They always sat down in front of the one.
Okay.
Right, so it would be like a 25% chance at random, and they got 90% on round one and 100% on round two.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, apparently a dog handler was used also during the course of all this, and I just wonder, mm-hmm. you know, because they used the dog handlers during this process – how much are the dogs sort of playing off what the handlers have?
Doesn't matter. The studies are blinded.
Are they blinded though?
Yeah, but
the studies that I mean, I don't know about this study, but this is not new.
No, it's not new.
I did an entire story on this for television for Al Jazeera, and we went to UPenn and we went to their working dog center, and they were doing a cancer study. And there, all of their studies were blinded. The training sessions aren't blinded. Obviously, the dogs have to be trained. Mm-hmm. Like heavily trained. So you'll put the cancer in the apparatus along with the placebo. And then the dogs will, every time they get the cancer right, they get a treat, they get their toy, they get whatever. Heavily, heavily. Because over and over, they're going to get it wrong at the beginning because they don't know what they're trying to do. And then eventually, they'll start to get the cancer right 100% of the time in training. And then they do the blind studies where they put down whatever. And they just record the one the dog goes to. And so then they look at it after they unblind it to know whether or not the dog was right or wrong. There's kind of no way to have trainer influence there because the trainer doesn't know.
Yeah, if it's blinded. This was booked as a proof of concept test mm-hmm. and not a real trial. So I don't know if that means it was unblinded or not. If it's gotcha. If it's unblinded, it's all bets are off. But the
if it's unblinded, it's all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just the clever Hans effect. But right. The other thing is, this isn't really replicating a diagnostic procedure. They're mm-hmm. leaping to this would be useful in diagnosing it, but they're not giving sensitivity and specificity as a screening procedure. They're only using a known target. So, like, what would the dog do if none of them had cancer? You know?
Exactly. Would he pick one? Would he guess one?
Would he just pick one? Is he going to have a 100% false positive rate? We don't know. Well, it's not implausible that, you know, if a cancerous breast could be secreting something in the sweat. Cause that's what it is. It's the sweat.
Oh, thing. Also we didn't do, theirs did like a blood and a breath test.
Yeah.
We didn't do anything about urine tests. Yeah. The two that I looked at were, I think, blood draws and breath tests. They didn't have anything to do with, with across the skin.
Yeah. So if there is something in the sweat and the dogs are being mm-hmm. trained to detect it, that's plausible. But can they actually do it? And will it have, you know, with the sensitivity and specificity that'll be useful? We don't have the data on that yet. As you say, we need more research, real, you know, useful research that will replicate how it would be used as a diagnostic procedure. But of course, if they can identify the molecule and detect it mechanically, that works too.
That works too. And also, is it specific to cancer or is it specific to some sort of disease process? Exactly. Yeah. Some sort of bodily reaction to disease. Because of course, they're picking, you know, a cancer sample and non-cancer samples, but I'm assuming their non-cancer samples don't also have MS or Alzheimer's or
maybe
any other.
Maybe it's just inflammation. What if it's just inflammation? Exactly. Yeah. That's the kind of that's the kind of validation you need to put an actual diagnostic test through. That, you know, these are just tricks that they're teaching the dogs. It's not that's not a validated diagnostic test. So the reporting, of course, is getting way ahead of where we actually are, which is what I meant at the beginning, was that I don't buy it. That's more the, soon we'll be having dogs sniffing out your cancer. It's like, not so fast.
Which is so stupid. And honestly, I don't think anybody even wants that.
Yeah.
Like, that seems like such a – what they want is a cheap, rapid cancer screen that they can send to impoverished areas.
Right,
of course.
Impoverished areas. Yeah. Right? That is the point. It's not – you're not going to – you know, in the in New York City, you're going to walk into your doctor's office and put the dog.
And there's
in front
a dog. Well, also even in an impoverished part of, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, I don't think the idea is to have dogs there. That's expensive too.
Yeah.
I think the idea is to use what the dogs are teaching us to develop further tools. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Jade, who's that noisy time?
Noisy.
The noisy.
The Clavin.
Who's that Clavin?
So last week, I played this noisy. So to start off, I'll say that nobody even guessed.
Really?
Nobody even guessed?
Not one guess, which I think is pretty funny.
Huh.
I have an idea. I'm going to play it for you again, and then I'm going to play for you an epic clue.
Okay,
here's the main noisy. I can make that noise with my mouth, by the way. And then here is the amazing clue that I'll give you.
Oh, those are
squeaky
shoes
on a basketball court or something.
Okay. That's your clue.
So that was squeaky shoes? Is it that simple?
Now that I think about it, the clue really isn't going to get you to the answer. But these two sounds, these two noises are related. They're very, very related. All right, so we know the basketball shoe squeak. We've all been to basketball games and heard that squeak a million times. And it is kind of funny if you think about it. Why do I hear that? Why do those shoes make that noise? And why is it making that noise up the basketball court a lot, right? So, okay, the noisy, which was sent in by Sarah Burrows, the noisy is a lobster. It's a lobster.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. Yes, the spiny lobster is making this noise with parts of its own body. So,
wait, what does that have to do with basketball shoes?
I'm going to tell you, and you're going to love it. Just so to scare away predators, the lobster rubs this rubbery, smooth protrusion that they have that's at the base of their antenna against the hard, smooth part of their heads. Okay, so we have a rubbery, smooth part and a hard, smooth part. The rubbery, smooth part is like the shoe, and the hard, smooth part is like the basketball court.
Oh my God, Jay, that clue would never help anybody.
I know, I realize that, but I gave you a shot, Kara.
You gave us an analogy. That's true.
At least you didn't say it was a Glavin or anything.
You know what it sounded like to me? You know, those toys that are like little noisemakers. They have the plastic part.
Yes, it does.
And then the metal part, and you spin them around.
Yep, I've played with them a lot. So let me continue to explain this. So these noises are made virtually the same way, these squeaks and the lobster noise. So this happens when these noises occur when two relatively smooth or flat surfaces become repeatedly stuck and unstuck by the forces of friction, okay? And they create a vibration that becomes the noise. So if you think about it, I couldn't imagine how many places along the bottom of the shoe are getting stuck to the floor and then suddenly unstuck, and then stuck again, and suddenly unstuck, and back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and it's happening, it could be happening tens of thousands of times in a millisecond. That's what makes that screech noise, right?
Cool. It's like static and sliding friction, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but this is called something very specific. It's called stick slip, and it's a phenomenon. Yep, and you can look this up. Yes, it's called stick slip. So the lobster figured out that it can do this, and then figured out that predators don't like it, and it scares away predators. And, of course, basketball sneakers make this noise because they don't like basketballs, which is weird. I'm kidding. That was a joke. But, yeah, so you get the idea. You get the idea of what's happening here. So it's cute, though, to think that lobster is down there, like, rubbing his antenna against his head to make this noise.
Aww,
and who would have thought that there was a relationship?
And then he becomes dinner anyway.
Exactly. Now, the lobster should learn to play basketball, and then, he won't need the shoes to make the squeak. All right, so thank you very, very much, Sarah, for that interesting noisy. I really enjoyed reading about that. And this week's noisy is very interesting as well. This was sent in by a listener named Kyle Hazegawa, and here it is. And there you have it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Interesting, yes. No, maybe.
It's a theremin. Kidding.
I'm sure that you could get one to make that noise.
Jay, that was so Trek-esque, dude. What the hell?
Bob, what tell me hell? About it. That's the reason why I picked it.
It's not the M5?
It rang so many like familiar bells in my head. I'm like, God, you know, this thing could be so many different things out of our past or whatever. But I will tell you, my clue is this is very modern. If you have any guesses or you heard anything cool this week, please email them to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
So the word this week is a follow-up from last week because like we do from time to time, we need to issue a correction. And we got a lot of emails from people last week when I was talking about ASMR saying, what is that word that she said it was like? She said frisson, but I think she meant frisson, which is definitely true. So I was referring to this word frisson, F-R-I-S-S-O-N. It's pronounced frisson. And of course, I read it as frisson, which is wrong. A frisson is a sudden, strong feeling or emotion, generally of excitement or fear. And it's often described as a shudder, a shiver, or a chill. Have you guys ever used this word in like your daily? Yeah, me neither. But apparently a lot of people know it. It's an interesting word for sure. And it's another one of those ones where we can point to the first time it was used in a literary sense. So the British writer and politician Horace Walpole on October 8th, 1777 in Strawberry Hill wrote a letter to the Earl of Harcourt. And in it, he used the word frisson. It's actually a French word. So this was the first time in English that somebody had used it to have this meaning, just amongst English speaking. It directly translates in French to fever, illness, shiver, or chill. And interestingly, it comes from an earlier Latin form that means friction, frictio, which is a mistranslation of an earlier form from frigere, which actually means to be cold. So it's mistranslated from a root word that means to be cold, which makes sense why they're going for this like fever, shiver, chill vibe with the word, but it was actually mistranslated. So the roots of the word actually do mean friction, which has nothing to do with a frisson. We call them pee shivers. Have you guys ever had a pee shiver where you have to pee so bad and you haven't gone and you get this weird shudder? It's a pee shiver.
Okay. Maybe I have.
Is that a woman thing?
I don't know. I have no idea. But I definitely have friends who I'll be like, ooh, pee shiver. And they'll be like, I get it. And then there are other people who are like, what the hell are you talking about? But yeah, frisson. So it usually happens with a strong feeling of emotion. It could be excitement.
Like music is one of the
music
iconic.
Could be key. It could be fear or anger, you know. And so, yeah, when you described having that experience when you heard really profound music, I think we all kind of said, yeah, we've been there. We've all heard a beautiful opera or a beautiful symphony, and it's done that to us where we got goosebumps. Another question for you guys, being Connecticutians. Mm-hmm. Do you call them goosebumps or do you call them goose pimples or goose flesh? Because that is gross.
Goosebumps first, but goose pimples is not that unusual.
Yeah, goose pimples, goose flesh is also not that unusual.
Goose
and both
flesh?
Of them... Both of them make the bile rise up a little bit. There's something super gross about saying goose pimples or goose flesh to me.
I just don't like the word flesh. I just don't like it.
Yeah, flesh is a very fleshy kind of a word. But yeah, frisson. So we've all had them. We know what they are. We can talk about them now. But it is slightly different than ASMR in that ASMR individuals have these frissons because of specific triggers like we talked about last
week.
Yeah.
It is definitely a counterintuitive way of pronouncing it, though, for an American anyway.
I know it looks like frisson, but it's missing an I.
Or even
and so when
frisson.
I see it,
even
or
frisson,
judge,
it's frisson.
I hear
frisson
when you say that.
Frisson, never think to pronounce it that way.
Yeah, it's frisson. Because it's French.
Yeah.
Yep.
Quelle surprise. All right.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Kara, you're going to love the theme this week.
Uh-oh.
The theme is dinosaurs.
Oh, yay! But last time we had a dinosaur one, I shit the bed, so
yeah.
We'll see.
Because you're going up against
you pee-shivered.
Okay.
Yep.
I know. It does seem that when people really are in their sweet spot sometimes, they have a harder time with it. But we'll see.
Yep.
So keeping with the theme, we're having a mini theme this episode. So three items all about dinosaurs. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Okay. Item number one, two dinosaurs, a velociraptor and a protoceratops, were preserved in a literal action pose in the act of combat as they clawed and bit each other.
Dang.
Item number two, most dinosaurs did not chew their food, but hadrosaurs did with their approximately 1,000 teeth. And item number three, sauropods, the largest dinosaurs, had an enlargement at the base of their spinal cords that acted as a relay center or second brain. Jay, go first.
All right, the first one, we got two dinosaurs, a velociraptor, a proceratops, and they were preserved. They were preserved in a literal action pose, like as if they knew, you know, people in the future are going to be looking at this. We got to look cool, guys, and we're going to die in 3, 2, 1. All right, you know, and they do it. No, this is ridiculous. You know, and in action, like, all right, so they got into an action. They're fighting, and then what? Like all of this liquid amber, like just fell on them. You know, like whatever tree sap falls on them. No, come on, Steve, what the hell? There's no way that they would be frozen in that pose. It's how could it happen? They'd fall over. You know, their arms would move. I can't think of a way it would all be, like, preserved. This better not be, like, yeah, and they were standing near each other, and they probably were fighting. Like, you're saying, like, right in the action pose, the literal action pose. You bastard. That's not – I know that one is probably true now. All right, hold on.
Just buying time.
I know, I'm just trying to hopefully something will hit me.
Or something. Or Steve will slip. He'll say something.
Or kind of correct me. Okay, anyway, going on to the second one. Most dinosaurs, they didn't chew their food. They didn't have to. Hadrosaurus did with approximately 1,000 teeth. All right, so 1,000 teeth, I'm not impressed. And they chewed their food. Well, first off, did most dinosaurs not chew their food? Did they swallow it whole? I mean, I could see, like, you know, sharks pretty much do that. Not pretty much. That's what they do. They don't chew anything. I could see that. So it's either like other dinosaurs or most of them did chew, which I've never seen anything on that. They don't look like they have the mouth to do it, to really chew like we do. And 1,000 teeth, I guess that's not a lot for a dinosaur mouth. Okay, that one's science. The last one, sauropods, and these are the largest dinosaurs, had an enlargement at the base of their spinal cord that acted as a relay center or second brain. Man, damn, I've read this. It could be wrong, you know, because this could be like, oh, it's not a brain. It's just a nerve cluster, but it's not really a brain. Damn. All right. I got to go with my initial idea that the stupid, like, literal action pose, that's what Steve wrote, in a literal action pose, that is not true. That is fake.
Okay, Bob.
All right. So, yeah, Jay, I felt the same way, but I'm thinking, all right, how could this have happened? I mean, I could see them fighting, and they both have mortar wounds. They both do a last kind of attack, kind of like not even standing up, but kind of like laying down attack. And yeah, clawing each other and biting each other. And then they just bleed out. And that's kind of how they stayed. I can see that happening. Not doesn't seem likely, but it seems possible. The one that got me is the second one. 1,000 teeth. Jay just kind of like, 1,000 teeth, whatever. 1,000. I've seen lots of dinosaurs. I've never seen anything close to 1,000 teeth. But come on, think about that. What do we got? 25, 30?
I like how we have 25, 30 teeth.
Depends on what state you come from, Bob.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So to me, that's just like 1,000. No, he's going to come out with some shit. Yeah, they had these weird teeth lining their esophagus going down there. What? I doubt it. I doubt it. And I'm even not even very certain about a dinosaur chewing food. I mean, don't they all have pointy, like, dinosaur lizard teeth? I'm trying to think of, like, flat teeth on dinosaurs. So that one just totally rubbed me the wrong way. The third one, spinal cords. Yeah, hind brain. Sure, I could see that. And maybe that's why I should pick this one. But I'm not. I'm going to go with the damn teeth. That's bullshit. 1,000 teeth.
Okay, Evan?
The action pose. Two dinosaurs. So how could this have happened? Something sudden, obviously.
Wait, happened. Can I change my mind? Crap. Never mind. I lost.
Something sudden obviously must have happened in order to capture them. It wouldn't be an amber thing. It wouldn't, you know, amber pouring on them. It wouldn't be, glacial approach or something like that, too slow. It would have had to have been something, maybe a volcanic eruption of some sort that encased them in something, or, I don't know, did they fall together, fall into something maybe? I don't know. I have a feeling, though, they're just because I'm not thinking of it doesn't mean it's not right. And then with the dinosaurs, yeah, 1,000 teeth, Bob, that is damn impressive. Could there be 1,000 teeth? Is that really the point of this? Don't sharks, some, you know, fish have like hundreds of teeth? And so maybe 1,000 isn't all that crazy. The thing about this one, though, is about the chewing of the food. I didn't know that most dinosaurs did not chew their food. What else were they doing with their teeth at the time if they weren't using it for food chewing? What the hell were they doing? What's the advantage?
The combing lice.
The pointy teeth. It's rip and swallow. Rip and swallow.
So just as a weapon, that's it. Okay. All right. But 1,000 teeth. Well, I don't know. And then sauropods, largest dinosaurs. The enlargement at the base of the spinal cord, a relay center, or second brain? I guess that could be. Second brain, though. I mean, you got to protect that brain if it is a second brain. Did they have what's down there at the bottom of the base of this? Oh, gosh, I have to think about it, but I don't have that much time. So, I think I'm going to go with the sauropod one, the enlargement at the base of the spinal cord. I don't think it was a second brain. I think Jay was maybe onto something. It's some sort of nerve cluster, but not really a relay center of any great import.
Is that the one Jay picked? I thought Jay picked the Velociraptor and Protoceratops.
I did say that.
He did.
Right? Yeah, so you guys are all over the place. You guys are
1, 2, 3. Each of us split. Chose a different
one. Oh, I see. He just happened to say that. I get it.
So,
I get
Kara,
it.
Yeah. The dinosaur expert, you're the tiebreaker.
Okay. So here are the things that I do know. Velociraptor and Protoceratops are both Cretaceous dinosaurs. So, because the first trick would have been if you picked two dinosaurs that lived in totally different eras, but they did, I don't know if they overlapped, but I know that they're both late dinosaurs, so there's a chance for this. So there's not one knock against it, so I'll say, okay, maybe to number one. Number two, hadrosaurs were duck-billed dinosaurs. They were plant-eating dinosaurs. They did not rip and swallow. They did chew. They had to chew. They ate plants. So I kind of like it. I don't like 1,000 teeth, just like you said, Bob. Yeah. 1,000 teeth is insane. That sounds too high. But I also feel like maybe they had 700, and is Steve going to really make a science or fiction where they had 1,000 instead of 700? I don't know. And then the last one, this is the one that sticks out the most to me off the bat, because unless there's new information that I don't know about, I was under the impression that the second brain down in their butt, like the brain butt thing, was a myth. That this was actually something that some people have posited. It was debunked, and that's that. And this was like back when I was in school. So unless there's like new evidence that's come to light that the brain butt thing is real, I'm going to say that that is the fiction.
Yay, brain butt.
Okay.
So we'll see.
All right.
Yeah, so you're pretty divided amongst all three of them. So.
Yeah, you didn't sweep us. There's that.
Yeah, that was good. I like a good spread like this. So that means they're all balanced. So we'll start with taking them in order. No reason not to take them in order.
Oh, boy. Oh fuck.
Wait, two dinosaurs, a velociraptor, and a protoceratops walk into a bar. No,
we're that's so what I thought you were going to say.
They get into a fight.
They're preserved in a literal action pose in the act of combat as they clawed and bit each other. Jay, you think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Yes.
This is cool.
Happened?
This is like the coolest fossil dinosaur
it's
ever.
Also
found.
Bullshit.
It's called Fighting Dinosaurs. That's the name of the fossil.
Oh, giveaway right there. Yeah.
So what they think happened, so they were fighting each other, and then there was a sand avalanche that like instantly buried them while they were fighting. And they got preserved in their fighting pose.
I happen to not believe it.
All right, look it up. So, I mean, like the Velociraptor is clawing the Protoceratops, who's biting the Velociraptor's arm. They're clawing and biting each other
in their death pose.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome. You got to look at the fossil. It's very cool. Fighting dinosaurs. Just a one in a whatever billion chance as the landslide caught them in the act of fighting. Totally cool.
Landslide.
That's really cool.
I have two dogs, and they play. And what they will do is they'll grab a toy, each at one end, and they will do this sort of stare down. And they will stand there for a good chunk of time, a minute or two, and just each of them kind of trying to get a little bit of maneuvering, but they're kind of locked in. So I guess if these two dinosaurs were sort of locked in something similar to that, there would have been enough time for something as sudden as a landslide to capture them that way.
Yeah, I mean, if the fight was a good fight, they're not running away.
Right. Oh, they were having at each other. Oh, yeah.
I love that. The coolest thing about dinosaur fossils is when they tell us more than just their morphology, but they tell us something about how they lived. Like when you can find plant matter, or there's a beautiful plesiosaur, which I know is not a dinosaur, it's a swimming reptile, at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. And it's the specimen that showed paleontologists that they likely gave live birth, because there's a baby plesiosaur in its belly. It's incredible. And there's no evidence of a shell. Yeah, it's incredible. Like, those are the beautiful, amazing fossils.
All right, let's move on to number two. Most dinosaurs did not chew their food, but hadrosaurs did, with their approximately 1,000 teeth. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
It is.
Yes! 1,000
Vindication. That's crazy, though. It's really 1,000?
Yeah, so they had – so I always double, triple check the sources here. Some sources say thousands in the plural. Some said hundreds. One said 960, and another one said 1,000, which seems like they just rounded it to 1,000. So I went with 1,000.
Are they like shark teeth where they just keep replacing?
Yes. There are multiple rows of teeth that are constantly being replaced. Now, why don't dinosaurs chew their food?
They don't need to.
Do they have gizzards? Do they have gut gizzards? I don't know.
They swallow stones.
That you're reversing the cause and effect. They do those things because they can't chew their food.
Gotcha.
They can't chew their food because their jaw doesn't allow it.
They don't have the side to side movement
that mammals have. Think of alligators and crocodiles. Right?
It's just up, down, up, down.
Yeah. They snap.
They rip the food off, and then they swallow. Now, Kara, you made an incorrect statement when you said that
hadrosaurs
had to chew their food because they ate plants, because sauropods eat plants, and they don't chew their food. They just nip off the food, right? They sort of bite it off and swallow it. How did sauropods digest their food if they couldn't really chew it?
Acid?
Gizzards.
So they just fermented the food in their stomachs for days. Okay. And so it's possible that sauropods, the largest dinosaurs to have ever existed, were just fart machines, just constantly.
Oh, yeah, they would smell so bad.
Yeah, producing amounts of flatulence.
Oof. Wow. And global warming and everything.
Wasn't there a crazy study? I feel like there was a published study like a year or two ago. Like, it was like silly, but where they tried to quantify dinosaur fart methane or something.
How come no dinosaur movie that I'm aware of ever had dinosaur flatulence?
Jurassic Park.
The sensors didn't allow it, Bob.
In Jurassic Park, didn't they burp or did it sneeze?
It sneezed.
Come on.
It took a dump. They went through its shit.
That's true. That was cool. There's like a triceratops poop, I think, to see if it was sick.
Science.
Now, the hadrosaurs, anyone know what hadro mean? Like the root hadrosaur? What's hadro?
Well, they're the duck-billed dinosaurs, but I don't know if that's what that means.
The duck-billed dinosaurs.
Water? Not water.
No. It means either thick or stout.
Oh.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so they're the thick lizards. But they are the duck-billed, like the Parasaurolophus, for example. Which is a favorite. Or Edmontosaurus, Lambeosaurus. A lot of the pretty... You know, and the cool ones, but half of them had the hollow, you know, heads that they probably sounded like really giant geese or something when they honked.
Yeah, the horns.
Yeah.
Is Mayasaur a hadrosaur?
I don't know.
The Mamasaurus? Let me look it up. I want to see.
So how did they choose their food though? So they're not really sure because their jaws, they still have the reptilian jaw. But yep. they simulated it, and it's really complicated. Like when they open and close their mouth, their teeth, the rows of teeth like move back and like front to back a little bit as they interact with each other. And that could chew up the food. So they, as you say, Kara, right, you find these individual fossils that tell you a lot. So there are hadrosaurs with evidence that they were eating tree bark. So they probably they probably ate pine cones and needles. Like, so it, you know, coniferous trees are largely inedible because they're sappy and hard and everything like that. Of extant species, like I know that moose can eat pine needles, but very few animals can, which is why they don't sustain a lot of life. But the hadrosaurs probably could, you know, eat pine needles and pine cones and tree bark and all that stuff, and they would just chew the crap out of it with their 1,000 teeth.
And by the way, because what I was thinking about is like, how would this one really random? It's like one individual be the only one who could chew. But of course, hadrosaur is a. I just looked it up. It's a family.
It's a family. Yeah. It's like saying
so it's got a lot. Yeah. It's got a lot of different individual species types underneath it. And yes, Mayasaur was one of them, the famous one with the nest of babies.
Mm-hmm.
Aww.
Yeah, cool. So they probably eat pine cones.
Yeah. Pine cones, yum.
Pine cones.
That's how I imagine it would say it.
Yeah. Well, that's from the movie Ice Age.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who says it?
Sid the Sloth is trying to convince these other mammals to eat. I think he accidentally ate their food, and he's like, oh, look, pine cones. Yum, yum, yum. If they were hadrosaurs, awesome. They might have bought it. All right.
Yeah.
All of this means that sauropods, the largest dinosaurs, had an enlargement at the base of their spinal cords that acted as a relay center or second brain is the fiction. It is, in fact, a myth, Kara. You are correct.
Woohoo!
But a very widely reported and believed myth, even to this day. Do you know who started it?
Probably some.
Florence Henderson.
I'm going to say Cope. Cope did a lot of things.
Cope?
Probably wasn't Cope.
No, it was not Cope. It was okay. It was Marsh. It was Yale paleontologist Othniel Charles Marsh, 19th century dinosaur paleontologist. He discovered that there was a canal in the vertebra over the dinosaur's hips that were like bigger than the brain case. And they said, maybe these huge creatures needed a brain in their butt, you know, a hind brain, in order to deal with the rear half of their bodies. They were so long, maybe the signals getting from the brain all the way down to their hind legs would be too slow or something. So that was the thought, but it was never turned out not to be true, right?
Later, it sounds like that would be for a blood vessel, no?
I don't know, but it's not a brain. Yeah. It's not a relay center or a ganglion or anything. It's just, it's not related to the nerves.
It's just a hump.
It's a cavity. Gotcha. Yeah.
So, because it does seem like the biggest problem for a sauropod, especially one that's more like vertical. Most of them were pretty horizontal, but would be like, how the f*** did they get blood up there?
Yeah. Valves.
You know. Valves. Yeah.
So that was one of those ideas that got into the lay consciousness and just stayed there, obviously for 100 years, even though it just turned out not to be true. But just the idea that dinosaurs are so big, they have to have brains in their butts, is just one of those things that resonated, that just people just keep spreading. It found its way into textbooks. I mean, it was just a really persistent myth.
Yeah, but, and then it only used 10% of its butt brain. That got out of control.
Right. But that's a persistent myth.
I love it.
Yeah. So good job, Evan and Kara.
Yeah.
Yay, sure, Evan.
Right, yes.
High five.
That was a fun one.
Well, it's vindicating, because last time I like really shit the bed on the dinosaur one. Yeah. Well,
it's not shit, it's coprolites.
There you go.
And dinosaurs are endlessly fascinating. I mean, obviously there's a lot of different species. They obviously spanned hundreds, you know, over 100 million years, a long period of time. I think last time we talked about dinosaurs, I used some version of, like, we are closer to T-Rex than T-Rex was to Stegosaurus.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's awesome. Yeah, that's and then you go to a museum and they have them side by side. I know. You're like, what?
So great. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they must have lived so close to each other. Yeah. They were neighbors.
The age of dinosaurs, actually a long yeah, right. time.
Yeah.
Multiple age ages.
As if it's right. This is the 20s, yeah. Okay.
You have to at least whack them up into Jurassic, Triassic, and Cretaceous.
And Cretaceous, yeah.
I please.
I used to think about this idea like when humans, like we finally kill ourselves and like an alien species is looking at us and they're like, look, they used to look at dinosaurs. You know, they used to look at these creatures that lived on their planet a long time ago. Like that would have been an interesting fact that they figure out about us.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
Hey, Steve, before you go to the quote, I have a... something I want to say.
Go right ahead.
I recently did an episode of the Survivor Typecast with friends that it's always fun. I did it once a few years ago. And basically just discussing one of the latest episodes of Survivor. So go to iTunes, look up Survivor Typecast, and it was uploaded recently. So check it out. Good episode. Oh, it was a fun episode to record.
Oh, cool.
Survivor.
All right, Evan, do you have a quote for us?
I do. Here we go. Truth is born unto this world only with pangs and tribulations, and every fresh truth is received unwillingly. To expect the world to receive a new truth, or even an old truth, without challenging it, is to look for one of those miracles which do not occur. And that was from an interview and spoken by Alfred Russel Wallace.
Oh, Russell. Wallace.
Nice. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. British naturalist, explorer, geographer, anthropologist, biologist, best known for independently conceiving the theory of evolution through natural selection.
Right.
Right along the same time as Charlie Darwin.
Well, Darwin did it much before he did, but he just dragged his heels for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
While he was getting all of his ducks in a row. And Wallace was like, hey, I had this idea. What do you think about it, Darwin? He's like, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. Well, let me publish, present my paper before yours in front of the Royal
Society. Yeah, let me go out to my – I left something in my wagon. I'll be right back. Off to it was the society.
In fairness, it was Darwin's friends who did that for him. Darwin didn't do it himself.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they pushed him. They said, listen, dude, this guy's going to scoop you. You got to – let's just present both papers and we'll do yours first and you'll get precedence.
Yeah, guys, there's a brilliant book by David Quammen, I think one of the best science writers of our time. He also wrote Spillover. He wrote The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, and that's kind of what it's about. And also the fact that he had like horrible gut problems and married his sister or his cousin.
His cousin.
It was his cousin. Yeah.
Regarding the quote itself, though, it's about basically, truth. We don't have these epiphanies, all these sudden miraculous moments in which, oh, okay, this is the way this is. No, we learn about the truths through hard work, discovery of evidence, hypothesis, testing, all the things the scientific method has taught us as the best way to approach what ultimately is the truth. But we don't get there without a lot of hard work, a lot of pain, a lot of effort, and a lot of naysayers along the way.
Absolutely.
It takes effort. It takes effort.
Right. But worth it.
But rightfully worth it. So. Absolutely.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure.
Roger that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.